Welcome to In the Studio. Redbeard here with the stories behind history's greatest rock album.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Today in the studio, one of the most anticipated debut albums ever. By this time in 1974, the anticipation for a new British band called Bad Company had grown into quite a buzz based on the pedigrees of the players involved. This new group would feature singer Paul Rodgers and drummer Simon Kirke from the English quartet Free, a band that scored a hit early in their career but by 1974 had broken up twice. On the other hand, Bad Company guitarist Mick Ralphs was enjoying some overdue success with Ian Hunter in the band Mott the Hoople. But Mott's breakthrough with All the Young Dudes came from an outside songwriter, David Bowie, and it altered the musical direction of Mott as well. Guitarist Mick Ralphs explains in the studio.
After the success with David Bowie, suddenly Ian came to the conclusion that this is what we have to do to sell records. We have to write songs like All the Young Dudes, and which it was fair comment at the time because we'd had no success till then. So he set about a mission of writing songs that were kind of that style, like Roll Away the Stone and Honolulu Boogie and all these that built up to a big chorus, you know, kind of like pop songs of the day, if you like. And they were great, you know, great songs. I was still in Mott when I was working with Paul, but by then I realized that I wanted to work with him and he wanted to work with me. I was just fulfilling my obligations to Mott because I'd been with them for some time. I couldn't just leave them, you know, I wouldn't do that. But there was no room for the stuff that I had been writing, which was more simplistic stuff. So when I'd met Paul, I had this great backlog of stuff that I'd written, which included Ready for Love, Can't Get Enough, Moving On, and a few others. I'd already written those. They were just, you know, demo tapes at home. And at the time I met Paul, he wasn't happy with his, it was after Free, he wasn't happy with this little band he was in. And basically he was looking for songs and someone to write with. And I said, well, you know, sing this, and he sung it great.
Bad Company singer, songwriter Paul Rodgers told me what he was searching for as the band Free disintegrated in late 1973.
I wanted to actually be free, if you'll excuse the pun. And I wanted to find a way to not be tied into a band.
What happened was that in between the two, the first time Free split up and the second time, and when it got back together, I had a band called Peace. It was just a three-member band. But I did play with Mott the Hoople as a guest artist, I guess. And in the band room, I met up with Mick Ralphs, and we started to noodle around on the guitars. And he confessed to me that he wasn't really happy with Mott the Hoople, and he had these songs that he wished they would do, but they didn't want to do, one of which was Can't Get Enough of Your Love. And I heard it, and I said, well, that's a hit. He said, do you really think so, man? I said, does a bear, you know? So he said, well, I mean, is it a song you could sing? I said, yeah, I certainly could sing that, no problem. Anyway, so we were getting along good about songs and stuff, and that's and the idea for forming a band came right there, you know, because I had it in my head that I wanted to come back, I wanted to tour the world. I'd had enough of untogetherness amongst the band members and things like that. I wanted a really strong band. Everyone was totally committed and totally together and able to deal with, say, in the States here, the size, venues and all that. That was the thing behind Bad Company. We struggled with the name, actually. For one, I actually considered the name Fury for a while, but it was too, like, free. And then I started to write a song called Bad Company, and I phoned Ralphs up and I says, Bad Company. He goes, that's it. And so we called the band it as well. And I think it was and is a very good name for a rock and roll band because it's got like instant rock and roll credibility, you know.
Initially, it was just Ralphs and Paul Rodgers working together on songs when former Free drummer Simon Kirke dropped by, according to Bad Company's Mick Ralphs.
Simon came to Paul's house one day, I remember, and he was a bit, after Free, was sort of, you know, globetrotting and just called up to see what was happening. And we said we'd been writing. In fact, I think initially we hadn't decided to form a group. We were just going to make a record together, Paul and myself. And Simon came in and was a natural choice to be. He said, well, I'll just play the drums. And we suddenly thought, well, why don't we just form a group here? You know, this is rather than just going in and making a record and calling it such and such. It's just make a group of it and try and make a go of it.
Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk.
It was very fortunate timing, because at that period in time, Zeppelin were forming their own label. In fact, that very month.
Which we didn't know at the time.
We didn't know, and Peter took us on, without a bass player, which showed how much faith he had in the group. But of course, we didn't know that at the time, but he was going to sign us up to Swansong. So it was a fortunate move all round.
Bad Company with Ready for Love are their 1970 debut, a song that Mick Ralphs had written while still in Mott the Hoople. Asking Led Zeppelin's manager, Peter Grant, to represent them was a ballsy yet risky move for Bad Company. There was a 50-50 chance that this new band would get lost in the shadow cast by the international Zeppelin juggernaut. But Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk wasn't too concerned.
No, we had an incredible superiority complex at the time, and we were out of individual, very popular groups, Mott and Free, and we were still in our mid-20s. The whole world was at our feet, really. And if Peter hadn't have taken us on, we would have gone for someone else, maybe Floyd's manager or The Who's manager, anyone who was big. And with only 6 or 7 songs, to audition with, it was a ballsy move, but it did pay off. And we enjoyed
lucky.
5 or 6 years of very, very nice success.
Next, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk explain why fans still can't get enough. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for Bad Company.
Hi, I'm Mick Ralphs.
And I'm Simon Kirk.
Hello, this is Paul Rodgers, in the studio for the original Bad Company.
Thanks, gentlemen. I'm Redbeard. Anniversary of Bad Company's debut album in 1974. Bad Company lead singer Paul Rodgers still remembers how he first connected with guitarist Mick Ralphs, even while Paul was touring in Free on the same bill as Mick in Mott the Hoople.
Well, I started to play a song that I played with Free, Soon I Will Be Gone, and Mick had a very similar song to that, and we just said, oh, that's nice. Oh, yeah. I was amazed that he had this other side to him that was totally not the sort of pop band, if I may say that, that Mott the Hoople was, he played me Can't Get Enough of Your Love, and I said, that's a hit, man. And he said, well, the band won't play it, I said, well, that must be really frustrating. They wouldn't do that. It wasn't their cup of tea, or their kind of material. So I said, well, if you can write material like that, I can sure sing it. And that was a pointer towards the direction it would go in, rocking and with a blues touch.
Songwriter for Can't Get Enough, Mick Ralphs.
The basic song followed the same sort of thing that I had done as a demo, a home demo, but obviously it takes on a whole new lease of life, and you've got 3 other strong people adding their part to it, people that you like and enjoy their music, just getting behind it. And it actually surprised me that it came out as good as it did. I'm still astounded at its success, really. It's a really simple song.
Bad Company's first single in summer 1974, Can't Get Enough, peaked at number 5 and immediately established them as a major new force in rock music. Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk.
Well, we had a very good drum sound even for, 74. Every instrument on the album was totally separated. We weren't all in one room. The guitars were done in the main reception room, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a huge reception room. Living room, rather, and my drums were in the kitchen. So that's, with all those hard surfaces and, flagstones and whatever. And Boz, we had in the bowels of the house with his bass amp. So we had incredible separation. And also the engineer at the time was Ron Neverson, who's now a big producer. At that time, Bonzo's drum sound was very much under scrutiny. This is in the days before these Yamaha reverbs and AMS machines and whatever. Neverson nicked a couple of ideas from Zeppelin, because he'd done a couple of albums with Zeppelin. And we found out that by putting in 2 ambient mics over the kit with the regular mics on each drum, and if you bring up the ambience mics when you mix, you get a very fat sound. So we applied that to just about all the tracks, particularly Can't Get Enough.
To complete the quartet, this new group, Bad Company, held auditions for bass player, settling on former King Crimson bassist Boz Burrell. Simon Kirk and Mick Ralphs recall the process.
We had amassed a dozen or so names, one of which was Roger Hodgson, before Supertramp, and he didn't make it. And Boz made it, really, because he was the last guy on the list, and he didn't ask what key, you know, the songs were in. All the others had to be shown G to C to whatever. But Boz just said, oh, no, don't tell me the key, I'll pick it up.
Yeah, his attitude was different to the others, and he liked that. You know, he wasn't the best bass player we'd tried, but he had the best attitude, and I've always believed that's like more than 50% of someone's worth in a band is their contribution as a personality, as a part of the setup. You know, if you can get on with people and you can play a little bit, then if you get on, you can play really well, you know, together, not individually, but you can make a good noise together.
I think it was maybe the minimum of a week and the maximum of 2.
Because we were raring to get into the studio. We'd got all the songs written and we said, well, look, they're not very difficult, you know.
By the time he'd arrived, I mean, we'd actually held 16 auditions, you know.
So, we just wanted to get on with it.
You know, we knew all the songs that were actually on the first album were already done and raring to go. And I think Boz had been with us, you know, actually said, right, Boz, you got the job, la, la, la. Oh, by the way, we're hoping to go into the studio very, very soon.
2 weeks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fortuitous step for us because Zeppelin were down at this place, Headley Grange, in Sussex, and John Paul Jones contracted flu. And so there was a week or 10 days where the mobile was lying idle. And Peter phoned us and said, look, you know, we've got a week of free studio time. You say you guys are ready, prove it. So we went down, and I remember almost with a certain amount of awe seeing some of Led Zeppelin's gear and Bonzo's drum kit, and you know, it was they were sliced bread at that time, and I really was a big fan of Bonzo's anyway. I wasn't a big fan of all of Zeppelin's stuff, but I loved John's style of playing, and I liked Jimmy's guitar as well. You know, so to go down and oust their gear with ours, it was I think, you know, it was great.
The whole thing was done in about 4 weeks, mixed.
That's, yeah. Because we had
gotten the songs to the point where we didn't have to routine them. We got them, you know, we worked out how we were going to do them in the studio. That's where a lot of bands waste a lot of time rehearsing in the studio. At that point, we had written all the stuff. So a lot of first albums are like that, you'll find.
The other thing was that we were also under contract. I mean, my contract and Paul's contract and Mick's contract with Island Records was still very, you know, very fertile.
Yes.
And we were actually, or Peter was trying to come up with a way whereby he could get us three off the Island label and, you know, completely onto Swansong. It was a move which wouldn't really be completed for a couple of years. So we had, you know, we were kind of held down by legalities around about November, December 73. And then there was a sort of light at the end of the tunnel when it looked as if Chris Blackwell, who's the head of Island, was going to give us over to Peter. And that's when Peter said, you know, you've got a week. Come on, let's see what you can do. And we did it. I mean, it was all done. I think the greatest thing for me was working with a mobile, working in a residential studio. I think at that time it was a novel idea. I think the Stones had done it a couple of times, mobiles, you know, but to actually go into a house, take it over, and be able to record any time of the day or night was a real gas.
We wanted it to sound live. We wanted it to sound, because at the time there were a lot of albums being made with people, you know, spending lots of time and airy fairy overdubs and all the backing voices and synthesizers. And we wanted to be simple and bluesy and just cut through, you know, like the sort of things that we'd heard when we started out, that suddenly was like a revelation, although we weren't pretentious enough to assume that we were going to, you know, achieve the same sort of thing for all time. It was, for us, it was an important thing to try and achieve that type of feeling in our first record, you know, make it sound, this is as close as we can get to what we really want to be like, you know.
Still to come, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk return to tell how the first Bad Company was recorded in a haunted English mansion.
Hi, I'm Mick Ralphs.
And I'm Simon Kirk.
Hello, this is Paul Rogers in the studio for the original Bad Company.
With Red Beard.
Thanks again, guys. The title song of which served as a theme song. Bad Company lead singer and composer Paul Rogers reveals the unorthodox location, Headley Grange in the English countryside, where they recorded that first Bad Company album.
You walked in and there was this marble floor and a huge sort of foyer thing, but ancient, you know, with a big staircase going up with all these spooky pictures going up the walls. But it had a great drum sound, so we put the Kirk in there, and then the guitar in the room, we're in another room, and then, you know, all in different rooms like that for separation, you know. It was pretty primitive, but we thought it was great. It was a big old mansion, a big old haunted mansion. There was like headless beings walking through walls all the time. It was quite peculiar. It was well haunted, yeah. And we did some funny things as well. I mean, we, like, for instance, when I did the vocal for Bad Company, I mean, I would fly pilot vocals. I mean, nowadays I like to keep the original vocal, so I always go for it. But at that time, it was the done thing to do a rough vocal and then redo the vocal properly, I suppose. But anyway, we put a microphone and headphones about 100 yards out into this field in the dead of night. Yeah, with just the moonlight, you know, to get an amazing atmosphere. So that's why there's that quite a haunting sound to the voice. Yeah, it was done in the middle of a field at the dead of night with the moon shining down. It was cool. So there we were in the middle of this field, and we just cut it, you know, in one take. It took about 3 hours to set it up, you know, with wires and leads and everything. But like when the time came, there it was, and we just did it in the one take.
A timeless classic. That song helped to propel the Bad Company debut album to the number one sales position in the U.S. Guitarist Mick Ralphs and drummer Simon Kirk remember the inspiration for the song Bad Company.
Paul had seen this film. There was a little B-Western going around the circuit in England.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges' film. Supporting whatever was the film of the day, I don't know.
Sound of Music.
Whatever, I don't know. You know, and then
Debbie Does the Dishes.
So he'd been to the cinema and he just happened to see this support film, you know. It was like a... But he loved it because it was real, like an ethnic Western. All the guys were mean, like they really were. You know, they weren't all handsome and clean shaven. They were dirty dogs, you know, and shooting people in the back. And, you know, they were all covered in mud. And he just liked that kind of real rough feel. And he thought, oh, great, you know, I'll write a song about these sort of people, you know, mean and moody, because it was like him. And he wrote this song with Simon that was conjured up this sort of illusion of, like, you know, the desperado types, you know, which we all sort of thought was quite a romantic notion. And then I said, well, it'd be a great name for the band, you know. And he said, oh, no, because your mother wouldn't like that.
I didn't like it.
I said, well, your mother doesn't buy many albums, you know, maybe just one. So I persisted with the notion that, because it was slightly tongue-in-cheek, because in America then bad was meaning good, you know, yeah. If you're bad, you're good. In England, that wasn't apparent at the time, but it had a kind of a double meaning.
By the time the members of Bad Company came to America, there was keen interest by the rock press owing to the fact that Bad Company was the first signing to Led Zeppelin's vanity record label called Swansong. But according to Simon Kirk and Mick Ralphs, it took Bad Company by surprise.
It was a surprise. I mean, we weren't aware. We were out just doing the gig, you know. We went out on the first tour with Edgar Winter. And we weren't, obviously we did loads of interviews, but you see that was nothing new because we'd done loads of interviews as Free and Mott the Hoople. So we weren't aware per se that there was a big, you know, interest in us by virtue of the fact that we were, you know, on Led Zeppelin's label. And we didn't even follow the charts that well, because it was only at the end of the tour when Peter Grant called us into, you know, his room or whatever on the last gig and said, you know, I've got this for you. And he pulled back a sheet and there was 4 gold albums. We didn't even know we got a gold album. So we were unaware of the hype. I'm a bit dubious about that.
I think
that,
in a way, we were naive to the enormity of the Zeppelin machine, I think, when we came to America. Because we'd known of Led Zeppelin, but we hadn't been in America that much. We'd been in America as Free and Mott a little bit. And then Zeppelin had happened after that. And we didn't realise they were playing these sports arenas but nobody had played before, you know. Nobody had played to, like, more than... The Beatles didn't even play to that many people. Maybe Shea Stadium, that was it. So there's this whole new thing going on in the industry. which meant lots of money, obviously, to lots of people, because suddenly there was a group that could sell thousands of tickets and millions of albums, as opposed to hundreds of tickets and thousands of albums. Mm. And to have that sort of clout working for us, we didn't really realise until we were over here working, then we suddenly got to realise how big they were. You'd hear them on the radio, and people say, "Are you really old with Led Zeppelin's manager?" We go, "Well, yeah, you know." Like, they were like in awe of it. I guess it was bigger than we hadn't really realised, I suppose. And it was a real help to us, but we were kind of always a bit flattered about all this sort of help we were getting from that connection. But it really helped us an awful lot, and we, in retrospect, it was a good thing to have on our side, you know. Every gig was as if it was our last gig, you know. We've always done that. Every time we do a take, it wasn't like, oh, we got 36 takes. It's like, if we hadn't got it in three takes, we weren't making it. We'd forget the song and go on to another song. I mean, a lot of bands spend days on the same song. We wouldn't. We'd get a song, we'd say, like, let's get in, set up, let's run it. And if we hadn't got it in three or four takes, then we'd say, forget it, next.
We'd move on.
The engineer
would
like pull his hair out because he'd have to change it, and he'd say, "Oh, we're going to do this song now," and then we'd play for a couple of times through. And if he hadn't got it down, he'd say, "Right, we're going to," you know, rather than do it in the conventional way, we wanted to keep the excitement on, make it so that so when you got it down on tape, it sounded like you were really performing. You weren't just going through the song for the 400th time. Mm. And I've always felt that's important, to keep that live essence in any recorded form. All the records that I like have that performance in them from the artists.
I think the reason why it was such a success was that it was a very American-sounding album, but it was by four British guys, and you've always got that curiosity factor from America to England and vice versa. And you know, a lot of people, even today, still think that Bad Company is an American group. But, it was an incredible success because all the songs were good. I mean, there's no two ways about it. They were simple, but it was at a time when you had, layered harmony groups. Yeah, you know, she had all the Chicago, you had Bazzic, Sweet,
yes.
Bands like Yes, you know, the more avant-garde records. And Zeppelin aside, there wasn't a band making straight-ahead rock and roll songs, you know, three or four minutes. I mean, Zeppelin were... they kind of rambled a bit, and they were noted for 20-minute solos and great live shows and lights, but, you know, their albums weren't necessarily song-oriented. Ours were, and I think that's one of the reasons why it was such a success.
Here's an update. Bad Company original bass player Boz Burrell passed away in September 2006. But the three surviving original members, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk, have reunited. As we gaze through the spyglass of time in reverse, we see that it was September 1973, and there's a ruckus interrupting the tranquility of the cool English country evening air. It's coming from the rural home owned by Paul Rodgers, who, in only 4 years with the British band Free, had quickly established himself as a powerful, soulful singer of the highest caliber. His mate, Simon Kirk, from the now disbanded Free, was there bashing away on the drums crammed into the close quarters, and the thick power chords echoing in the night of the pastoral English setting came from the Les Paul guitar in the hands of Mick Ralphs, late of British band Mott the Hoople. That night, only in the wildest rock and roll fantasy could one imagine that exactly 1 year later, Rodgers, Ralphs, and Kirk would be playing those embryonic songs as Bad Company in front of 73,000 fans packed into the University of Texas football stadium in Austin. But that's precisely what happened, setting Bad Company on a Hall of Fame-worthy path 4 decades ago. I spoke to Bad Company guitarist, co-founder Mick Ralphs, who answered first, followed in order by Bad Company singer, co-founder Paul Rodgers, and then Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk.
We never anticipated, well, you don't when you're young, you don't think about more than about a year ahead at the most. But fortunately for us, people still want to see us, and we still want to do it, so that's great.
I'm not that surprised that we're still doing something musically, because... well, that was on the cards from day one, really. I think we're all very passionate about music.
Yeah.
The music we listened to and the music we were actually playing ourselves. And so I would have thought that, 40 years down the road, we would be doing something. And I'm actually surprised myself at how fresh it sounds when we come back together and we're playing these old songs. which are, well, 40 years old.
Yeah, but they and, still and sound good. Yeah.
But there's still a lot of life in them, really a lot of life.
Absolutely.
And I think, to me, if I could say it, the records we listened to when we were getting turned on to music were actually 40 years old. You know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Albert King and all these guys. We were listening to quite old music, but to us it was very, eternal music. I can still listen to it now.
Yes.
And groove. And I think we took something from that, and that's probably part of what we do.
Well, yes, because music of that caliber doesn't date. Doesn't go out of, you know, it doesn't sound.
Yeah.
The recording techniques have changed, but the actual grooves.
Absolutely.
And the
I guess
feel and the
maybe
passion
we're the old blues men of the 2010s.
Well, yeah. We've taken that thing on. You know.
We have. Did you get that red beard?
Yeah.
I tell you what, though. You know, it's funny. That I agree with what Paul said that whenever we got back together, and it's like we were never away.
Well,
it's amazing.
To jump in there, I think Simon's right there. Well, that one of the things that is probably keeps this thing fresh is we don't tour all the time. For us, I mean, I'm not saying that if anybody that tours all the time, there's anything wrong with that. That's great if that's what you want to do. But we don't. We tour every couple of 3 years or something like that. So when we do come together, it's fresh.
It's fresh.
It's more of an event instead of just a routine, because a lot of bands, they do work until it becomes probably to them like the daily grind. With us, it's always exciting. So there's a slight, you know, not knowing what's going to happen about it, which is great.
There is, and it's interesting, you know, there's so many songs, as you say, there's so many songs in the catalogue that we actually have to play.
Yeah.
That the set, I mean, it's just a matter of rearranging the songs into a different order and creating a different show each time we go out.
Yeah.
And what happens is you put a set list together and we kick off with that, and then that's going to develop through the shows as we go on. So each gig is unique, and each tour is unique too.
Yeah, because the set sort of changes as we go along, doesn't it? We'll say, well, let's try that one there tomorrow. Yeah. It's good. It keeps you on your toes. Nothing's set in stone. But we have, as Paul says, we have a great collection of songs, fortunately for us, that people want to hear.
The first public proof that a Bad Company 40th anniversary tour was imminent came with their impressive live performance of their signature theme song on the popular Tonight Show with Jay Leno, which made me wonder, wait a minute. Had Bad Company, one of the biggest bands of the 70s, ever appeared on American network TV before? Simon Kirk answers first with Mick Ralphs, then Paul Rogers chimes in.
Yeah, we did Don Kirshner's rock concert, I think twice.
We did two different shows. We did the in
with ABBA. Believe it or not, it was with ABBA.
Was it?
They just had Waterloo. And I remember watching from the side of the stage Swedish girls in their leather pants. It was rather nice.
Don't look so clever now, though, I can tell
you.
No,
they don't look so clever now. But but that was...
Sorry, girls. I don't mean it.
I think those were the only two shows, Redbeard, that Bad Company play. I might be wrong.
There was two. There was one called In Concert, and then the other was called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert.
Yeah.
Because the one Keith Mooney introduced us on, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. And it was a whole show we played, didn't we?
Yeah, we came running on, remember?
Yeah.
Ah. And you had the Wurlitzer in those days.
That's right, yeah.
But the Tonight Show, it was the first time we played in a year together.
And I must say the sound they got for us was fantastic.
Boy.
You know, Sandy and Charles there, they
did a great job.
Sound was really inspiring. We just were able to really...
Yeah, because we've never done those late night chat show things, if you want to call them that. But it's become more and more in England as well. They feature a lot more rock bands on those sort of shows now than they used to. Mm. And on the Jay Leno show, they were really geared up to a rock band. There was no, like, can you turn it down, boys? And we just play your thing, and it was great sound.
Well, they also, I mean, Leno has a great band, a great house band.
Oh, yeah.
You know, about a seven-piece band, and they were playing really loud. You know, so when we came on, it wasn't like it was a big deal. As Mick said, no one said, hey, guys, can you turn it down a bit?
Oh, yeah, I mean...
Which is a kiss of death,
thank you.
Isn't it? Remember?
Yeah, we've done British TV. Well, I mean, hey, you know... But all the camera crew walked off because it was too loud.
It was like
it was enormous acoustic.
And we were like, "Where's everybody gone?" You know? and it was a different. It was kind of square in those days. I mean, I think it might be a little bit different now.
But, yeah, it's a little bit better, but it was very rinky-dink, wasn't it, in those days? Poor old Bob Harris.
Well, Bob Harris, that was a good show, though. Did you do that many times? Yeah,
he's a good lad.
Yeah, he was.
But Whistle Test, it was run on a shoestring budget, and They had the cameraman from the gardening programs. These old guys, about 80, just wanted to go home. Didn't want to hear anything noisy at all. I think G pulled us in the end. Peter Grant said,
no, come on, boys.
He said, it doesn't sound like
that. If you can't play properly, then we'll leave it. Sound like a folk group.
He kept saying, can you please turn it down a little more? And it was Feel Like Making Love. So the verses were
actually loud. Oh, yeah, I guess,
you know, the verses were okay because it's, you know... But then we hit the
chorus kicked in and
suddenly the cameras just went limp.
Yeah.
And they just sort of left, you know, dangling. And
it's very old-fashioned, the BBC. Well, it was in those days.
Bless them. Yeah. We probably shouldn't say too much because we might want to do a TV show.
Oh, yeah.
Down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
Loved them. Smashing.
Fabulous.
Lovely.
Right. As a sidebar, it's important to note that between Bad Company's 30th and 40th reunions, Paul Rodgers accepted a challenge that on paper looked impossible, even for his legendary voice, that being two world tours and an album with arguably the most popular band in the world, Queen, singing in tribute to the late Queen vocalist Freddie Mercury. I asked Paul Rodgers of Bad Company what he brought back to his band.
Well, it was an incredible experience. I mean, because he had a 50-foot thrust that went right out, or 50 yards or something. It was a really long thrust that went right out deep into the audience. And you're looking at about, 50,000, 60,000 people in somewhere like, where was it?
Sarajevo.
Kiev. Yeah, Sarajevo. Yeah. All these Eastern European places that we've never played before.
That's
and it was,
right.
It was quite amazing to, rock you. It was just amazing to be at the centre of that, you know.
Yeah.
And they played our songs well too. I mean, they did Feel Like Making Love. We did Bad Company. We arranged to have the piano come up through the stage.
Oh, wow.
In smoke. And I would start to play before I appeared on stage in smoke.
Wow.
And a couple of things happened there. A couple of Spinal Tap occurred. There were some Spinal Tap moments, I have to say. But it was it was very theatrical, and one took part in that. You know, lots of big stage, a lot of running around. Well, the fans absolutely loved the songs. We were in Italy, and we played, I think it was I Want to Break Free. And the audience actually took the song. I let them take the song, and they sang it. Mm. And they knew the words and every breath that Freddie had taken on the record better than I did. Wow. So, I want to break free. Breath. I want to, you know, I mean, they were like, I just was amazed. They were actually louder than the band. They drowned us out.
Wow.
So we couldn't hear the band. So it was pretty amazing. But they're a super, I mean, you know, I say this, they are a super commercial band. They're a super commercial entity, and I don't think they would deny that themselves. Where we are, though, I think we come from a different place. We definitely come from a different place. You know, the lyrics are simpler, and there's more time, there's more space in the music, you know, for the audience to step in, and which they definitely do. And I think, you know, dare I say, I think we have... There's a lot more soul in what we do. And that's not to criticise anyone, but it's the difference between, you know, the way I see it.
Speaking for me, you know, I saw Paul and Queen at Nassau Coliseum, and I was bowled over. I mean, number one, it was just great to hear him sing again. And I hadn't heard Paul sing
Simon.
For many, many, many years. And it was just great. And also, I love Brian May's guitar work. I think he's a fantastic player. And it worked with Paul. I think Paul and Brian worked really, really well together. And obviously, the more operatic songs, did you do Bohemian Rhapsody?
We did. We did, actually. Same key, everything.
Wow.
But what we did with that, actually what they did themselves was they used footage. Because it's such a complex song to actually recreate on stage. And then we all ran out at the end and that's how we handled that. And it was nice, you know, it was a nice tribute to Freddie because throughout I'd always been a big fan of Freddie. I thought he was a great frontman, a really great singer, you know, a great personality. That was before the tour. By the time I come off, I loved the guy. I thought he was the way he would have had to handle the job, as it were.
I thought
he was just amazing, you know.
Well, I went to see Paul with Queen at Wembley in London, and like Simon, I thought it was amazing. The show was fantastic. I knew some of the guys, Roger and Brian, and some of the side guys. But to see Paul up there, you know, doing those, you know, I suppose, classic Queen songs, but with his own soulful take on it. I thought it was great that he did it like that. And he was definitely Paul, you know, there was no doubt about it. It was him. And I thought that was great that he put his stamp on it. You know, he wasn't just like fitting into the Queen mould, whatever you want to call it. It was definitely Paul with Queen. And I thought that was great. And Paul's always done that. He's always had that authority or that stamp of individuality in whatever he does, and particularly in Bad Company, obviously. It's all wrapped up in Paul being Paul. I mean, basically, he's just a great singer, and that's Michael, what we love.
Great stagecraft.
We did a version of your song as well, though, Can't Get Enough of Your Love.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow. They nailed it to the floor. It was great.
Cool. Yeah. That was great. You know, you do other things and you bring it all into the context of what you're doing. I mean, Simon's done other things. I've done bits and pieces. I've got a little blues band project on the side just to keep playing, you know. And it's you know, all that comes into what you're doing as Bad Company. You just put all your little bit of extra knowledge in and extra experience and put it into the pot.
Along with American TV's reappraisal, apparently there's been a rethink for Bad Company regarding making live performances available to their fans. Now think about it. Can you name one superstar arena-filling band in the 70s without a live album in their original catalog? Filing out after a killer concert on your way to the parking lot, how many times have you or someone with you remarked, "Wow, I sure wish I could get a recording of that show we just saw"? Here's Simon Kirk.
Yeah, I think that when I'm on my way to the car, and then I wonder where the hell I left my car. You ever done that? Left an arena, think, where the hell did I put my car?
Well, back in the day, it wasn't such a thing that bands did, was it? People didn't sort of make DVDs and put out
live albums with a kiss of death in it.
Peter Frampton had a huge...
Radio wouldn't play them, would they?
That's right.
Except Frampton. Yeah. There's only Frampton who had a good one.
But it's, as time went on, taste changed, and then we got into the digital age and everybody was making videos and DVDs.
I think the quality has improved on live now as well.
Yeah.
You can actually... I mean, you know, you've got to capture a good show if you're going to do it. But Wembley, we got lucky because we'd planned to record that night. You never know if the night you're going to record is going to be a good night.
No, you can't predict that.
Do you think? But it happened to be a great night.
Yes,
it really did. Yeah. I mean, I've said that before, actually, but it is true. You know, we did, and we caught one.
But you're right, in the old days, it was all very hit and miss, recording bands live anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The technology wasn't there. You know, you're still fiddling around with cassette machines and, you know, it's much, much more organised these days, which makes for better sounding live albums, you know.
Actually, we're going to be releasing live on each show. It will be available after the show.
Yeah, which
so
is
that's,
great.
That's something that can be done nowadays, which is incredible.
Yeah, we're recording each show, Redbeard, and people can buy it at the end of the show.
That's great.
Yes, it's amazing. Get it on the night.
I think it's a better souvenir than a T-shirt. Which is usually $40, and it wears out after three wears. And here you get a DVD, you know, or a CD for, I don't know, $12-15. You know,
it's a nice memento.
It's a better memento, I think.
It is.
A crappy T-shirt.
Been there, done that, got the T-shirt, right, Simon? When we come back, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk confess to being unprepared for instant stardom, particularly in America. The importance of their legendary manager then, Peter Grant of Led Zeppelin fame. Why there were cows about when Paul Rodgers sang on the actual recording of the song Bad Company? And a funny and touching eulogy of their original bass player, Boz Burrell. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Bad Company. With lead singer-songwriter Paul Rodgers and drummer Simon Kirk, both graduated from the British blues rock band Free, guitarist-songwriter Mick Ralphs, ex-Mott the Hoople, and bass player Boz Burrell on sabbatical from a stint with King Crimson, the expectations for this so-called supergroup were exceedingly high, according to first Simon Kirk, followed by Mick Ralphs and Paul Rodgers.
The thing about a supergroup, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Because, it opens a lot of doors and people want to interview you if you're from three well-known bands. But ultimately, it's down to you or the band to deliver the goods. You know, I mean, Blind Faith didn't do it. You know, they released one dubious album. They didn't tour very well. They only did one tour. Crosby, Stills and Nash, they knocked it out of the park. Ultimately, it's down to the music and... It opened doors, and the Zeppelin clout, it certainly helped. But we did deliver. Bottom line is, we did deliver.
Yeah, it was up to us at the end of the day. And that was quite apparent when Peter became less and less available to manage us as time went on, because he was involved in Zeppelin and various other crises that came up. Mm. So we held our head up and carried on as long as we could. And but it was a great association, and I think it did nothing but help us get to where we got.
Yeah, and I mean, we still see Robert and Jimmy. Comes to the shows. He was at Wembley, actually.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And
Friends, it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Good lads.
Good people.
Run with the Pack, utilizing orchestral strings on that ride out there, was the title song to Bad Company's 1976 third album, and like the first two, not recorded in a conventional recording studio. Matter of fact, on Bad Company's first album, Paul Rodgers had sung his actual vocal on the album and band's theme song, while Rodgers stood outside Headley Grange in a field under a full moon at midnight.
Yeah, I did what they call a pilot vocal, and when you do a pilot vocal, you put a sort of leather hat on and these glasses and stuff.
I remember one time a guy said to me, he said, I believe Paul did the vocal to Bad Company. I said he did it on the lawn at with a full moon. And he said, oh, outside. I said, well, lawns usually are.
Outside, well, it was a lawn in the studio. This place had everything, man.
It's just we had to wait about a year for a full moon to get the atmosphere.
It was foolish.
Yeah, it was foolish. Yeah. No, it was.
Well,
It was a masterstroke.
We did the track, and I did the pilot vocal, as they call it, you know, with the leather hat and all the things. And we set up the microphone and the headphones, everything. It was about 100 yards of lead, actually, over fences and cow shit and all this stuff. And everything, we set it up, and then we waited till the evening. Right? And then I clambered up there with a torch
and
headphones.
Yeah.
Hello?
One, two,
it was really
two.
Strange. I was standing in the middle of this
field. We could hear the birds, the owls
and wind blowing and stuff like that.
It was great, actually. Poor Ron Nevison there.
Yeah.
And
they played the track, and when they played the track, it was very eerie just to hear the dang, dang, dang.
Especially in the nighttime.
It just was really eerie and very atmospheric. And at the end of it, there was a wind that just went across the microphone. There's a cool wind blowing, you know.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. It was little things like that happened all the time with us.
Organic,
but magical.
From Bad Company's 1976 third album, Run With The Pack, Silver, Blue, and Gold is a timeless beauty that helped the album be Bad Company's first million seller. But why go to such lengths as recording in country manors, castles, and a French chateau in order to create atmosphere? First, Bad Company's Paul Rodgers responds, then Mick Ralphs, followed by Simon Kirk.
Ooh, that's a good question. Basically, the answer to that would be that is what it's all about.
Yeah.
Amen. That's what we try to do.
Yeah.
And whatever it takes, that's what we'll try and do. Yeah.
We strive to be a little bit different, but, you know, within the context of a thing like recording, try these things, you know, set the guitars up in front of a fireplace, you know, Paul sing outside, whatever. Mm-hmm. Things that aren't norm, but just to try it. And it has its own sound, its own drawbacks, but it's, why not? You know, give it a go.
It does have its problems sometimes. I remember when we were in France, and we were doing Run With The Pack down in the south of France.
Yeah.
And they had me out on the veranda, and it was just, and it, we'd have to stop every now and again because a moped would come by delivering pizza, right? I'm running with. Oh, stop.
Do you remember Boz's arm was down in the boiler house, and and the woman, Madam somebody, kept coming in to try and get the boiler fixed, and Boz's amp was in there. He wasn't there, but his amp and microphone was. So we'd be playing away, you know, on doing the track.
Oh, right, the ghostly amp would just be working down there.
Yeah, and then you'd hear this woman arguing with a plumber.
Over the
bass track.
Take five.
Yeah, okay.
Madame.
But see, that's why, one of the reasons you go into a studio in the old days anyways, because to make it very clean and sort of that didn't happen. But what that meant for us was it got too clean and we couldn't even see each other and there wasn't any sort of the connection that we have live.
That's right.
That live thing is what it's all about, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we really should be trying to recreate the live spirit in a studio environment so it's clean and you don't have mopeds and
staff. But even so, when we were doing it like that, we were always congregate wherever he was playing.
Right, long leads.
We could see him, long leads, and we had eye contact all the time. It was great. We did the first three albums like that, didn't we?
Yeah, in houses.
And then, the fourth was the chateau, so they were all kind of the makeshift locations.
Next, you'll hear funny and fond memories of Bad Company original bass player Boz Burrell. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and lots more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Bad Company's Paul Rogers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk.
This is Simon Kirk of Bad Company.
This is Mick Ralphs of Bad Company.
This is Paul Rogers of Bad Company in the studio with Redbeard.
Sadly, the man who played bass on every Bad Company studio album, Boz Burrell, passed away in 2006. All four original members last worked together in 1998, and Boz also played on Bad Company's 1999 tour. Remembering Boz, Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk goes first.
Speaking quite frankly, he imbibed and he indulged.
He had a good time.
In nefarious substances, Redbeard. He was a drinker and he drank a lot and smoked a lot. And unfortunately, he paid the price for it.
But he never looked...
He was never, was never inebriated or anything like that on stage.
Never.
He was always very, very together. I mean, he's a great bass player.
Fantastic.
A really good guy. I mean, the thing I liked about Boz, and you get to think about it on reflection, don't you, when someone's passed, you remember all the great things about him. And he was a very melodic bass player, very musical.
Taste, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, he would, it wasn't just dum-da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. It was like do-do-do-do.
It was very melodic, wasn't it?
Yeah, he would know, he would play lead sometimes and then drop down to lock with the bass drum and... Yeah.
It was just a different take, wasn't it? He had a different approach, which
it was more,
that's what we liked about him, because we tried a lot of other bass players that were good.
Lord knows we tried.
He was the last on the list. We had a list of 16 bass players, and he was the last guy.
I wasn't even actually sure when you said, we'll have Boz, come on.
We'll get him down. Well, he did a crafty, didn't he? We got him down to rehearsals. We were all like waiting to play something. So he said, what do you want to do? He said, I want to go to the pub. So we all went to the pub and got horribly drunk.
I think we bought it, actually. We took a checkbook and bought the pub.
Probably.
The check bounced all over the place, but we had free drinks, do you remember?
Yeah.
Backing out the car park into the pub.
Yeah.
And then driving off, oh dear.
Anyway,
sorry.
We came back and played a load of rubbish because we were all drunk. And then the next day, Paul says, what did you think? I said, I don't know, I was a bit drunk, I think. He said, so was I. And Paul says, but I think I offered him the job. I said, oh, well, never mind.
I liked him from the word go because...
He was such an endearing
character.
I tell you,
the very first song we did was Little Misfortune.
Yes, it was.
And it was in G, if I remember.
Yeah, it was.
And he said, well, it goes from G to F to C. He said, no, just give me I'll figure it out.
The gist of it.
Wow, and he did, he really did figure it out. And it wasn't until later that I found out he'd only been playing bass... less than a couple of years. The fact that he'd been with King Crimson, which I never really liked them, I thought they had a great album cover, but that was about it. it didn't really endear, in the court
of
the Crimson King,
the 70s,
unbelievable. But when he wandered in, he was a great looking guy and he had a very laid back attitude and great smile, and
he was
very endearing.
He was great.
And through a haze of alcohol he got even better.
He was the missing link, if you were. With a band, it's all about the people as much as the talent, I think. Mm. You've got to really get on with each other for the magic to work, And I've seen bands put together, the so-called big names. It never really has, because it's all about the people. And if you've got great people you work with, you can make great, even greater music.
I tell you what, you could take Boz anywhere and there's always someone who knew him.
I know.
You could go to bloody Newcastle or Swindon... walking down the aisle, hello, Boz. Hello, Squire. Yeah. You all right?
No, we all think very, think fondly of him, and we all miss him, obviously. I hadn't seen Boz for a number of years when I heard the news that he'd passed.
He was living out in Ibiza, wasn't he? I hadn't seen him for, I think, the last time.
It was 12 or 15 years since we'd been in.
Long time.
We hadn't worked together for a long time, and then he got into his jazz, and then he moved to Edinburgh in Scotland, and played with a soul band. And then he moved to Spain, I think, somewhere in Spain, for the climate, because he was getting his joints off.
He always loved Ibiza, though, didn't he?
Yes.
He always used to go
there. It was like the sun.
Yeah.
So probably when I got the call, it would have been 12 or 15 years prior to that I'd actually seen him and been with him. People like that, you think they'll live forever.
1999.
Huh? And the interesting thing was...
99, yeah.
But the interesting thing was that when he died... we hear that he was actually teaching someone a bass part.
He was actually exactly playing the guitar.
Isn't that amazing? And it was completely out of the blue.
He just fell off the stool with
and
the guitar
just slid
in his hands.
Down and that wasn't unusual.
No, that was what he would have done anyway.
You know, so that's in a way,
he fell off.
He went out.
I don't think anybody thought he was. Yeah. He was serious. They thought he's had.
He didn't get slid under the table.
Yeah. But he actually had a guitar in his hand, I remember. Because he was always trying to tell me how to play jazz, and I hated it because I didn't want to know.
Dweedly-doo!
He'd say this E-flat seventh squire with a flattened fifth and all this. So I don't know what it is. I don't know what it sounds like. I don't want to know what
he
it is.
He did get a bit jazzy towards the end, dear old boy. So I
but bless him.
The love and affection that Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk share for one another, as well as the timeless music they created as the original Bad Company, is so obvious that it begs the question, why did Bad Company ever stop? Paul Rodgers reminded us that at the dawn of the 80s, rock bands were heading out into uncharted territory, and not everyone was coming back.
It had all become a bit...
Well, when Bonzo died, and I just felt we were flying too high.
Yeah.
Something had to give, and I just wanted to come off the road and...
I think if we hadn't stopped, something terrible might have happened to him.
Yeah, because we were out flying out there, weren't we, really?
Yeah.
It was like, whew.
I think Paul saw the red light before we did, because we wanted to keep going, but in retrospect, we needed to just pull back and reflect on what we'd done. You know, when you're going along at that pace... with that amount of interest or money or accessibility, whatever you want to call it.
Becomes an industry.
Becomes an industry and you become part of it.
Itself. Yeah, it's a big
you start
turning.
Beating yourself up.
Not worth it.
No.
And I think, by the same token.
So you had to put the brakes on, and thank God you did.
Getting back together, we know within half an hour if it's going to work. And it does work. And the times that we've reunited... It's worked.
But we get together now because we want to, not because, then it was like, well, okay, lads, come off a 3-month flat-out tour, go and write some songs, do another album, then do another tour. It's like, I'm not complaining. We had a great time, but the pressure...
But there was times like Burning Sky when we turned up for that
songs.
Album.
Yeah.
Yeah, we came right off the road, and then, okay, lads, make another album, and it was really, really tough.
Going, well, what have you got? Have you got this?
We almost thought, well, we'll record what we've got, but we probably won't release it because we just don't have the energy to give it what we feel it
that's
needs.
That's right.
And
because up to that point, we always had a few songs in ready for the next record. Oh, I think it all just culminated around that time. The business can do that to you, and if you don't watch out, it'll crush you. Because that was another
it'll
band.
It'll just eat up your life, But I think it's good. I mean, looking back now, I can look back on it fondly, really, because there's some great memories, and we survived.
Yeah.
And we're still here, and we can still kick it out there, I think, fairly well.
Absolutely.
So,
It's very enjoyable these days.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk. Special thanks to Chris Crawford. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and check out the biggest names in rock and roll at inthestudio.net.